My name is Clancy Immerslin, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad to be here. For those who were here last night, I was tired and bedraggled and had jet lag and told my story, and it bored me even. But tonight I'm just watched Wisconsin beat Michigan. Just watched Ohio State get beat by Illinois. Just watched Virginia Tech win the first time they beat Florida State in 40 years. While the rest of you were reading your big books, I was watching television. I am glad to be here. First of all, I want to thank Arlene, our chairman tonight, and her husband Daniel, and Patrick, who came and met me at the airport, because I was really kind of feeling down. I've been up late every night this week for one reason or another, good reasons, and I didn't get much sleep. I had to get up 5 o'clock in Los Angeles to catch a plane. I really didn't sleep well in the plane. I really got off the plane. I was tired, and we'd been sitting on a ramp in Washington in the rain for an hour. And their smiling faces just boosted me up, really made me feel better. I want to say one thing to Alan, too. I gave him a bad rap last night. I said that no one told me I was supposed to speak on Friday night. And apparently he had told me several times. At my age, if you haven't told me within the last hour, it don't count. It's not easy being old. I'm one of the few octogenarians you'll hear. When I was about 70, my doctor started giving me iron tablets for my blood, I guess. And I don't know what the hell that's for. But I've been taking iron tablets for 10 years now. And a few months ago, I'm not going to tell you why, but I've been reading some advertising, and I tried my first Viagra. And I didn't know that if you take iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now every 6 hours I face north. Yeah. I'm sorry that I missed Bob yesterday because I was on a plane. I'm sorry I missed Larry. I always enjoy listening to Larry talk. You're an Ohio State booster, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's big and tough. I really felt bad they lost, Larry. Last week they beat my alma mater, Wisconsin, so it was who cares? But we've had excellent speakers, and it's been a good weekend. And as I said, last night I somehow got to talk about sponsorship, and I told my story instead. And not surprising, because my story is really based on sponsorship. I had slipped for many years, and I found a man who I could listen to, and he changed my life, and I took it through little by little. And so if you weren't here last night, let me give you a quick abbreviated précis of what I said. I used to drink, and I had a hard time in AA. I met this guy who was mean to me and saved my bacon, and now I'm wonderful. That pretty much is it. Good night. Really, though, I really want to talk about something that maybe some of you have heard me talk about it before, but it's always in my mind. And something, if you're new, I travel around quite a bit. This year I've been in the South Pacific and Europe and many states, and I get around a lot, and I know a lot of A's and all over Canada and Costa Rica, a lot of places. And you hear different things in different places. You hear little talks about this and that and complaints about A and this and that. And there seems to be, in the last year or two, a little wave of discontent in certain areas about certain aspects of Alcoholics Anonymous. One that seems to be the most prevalent is the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous is too selective. It insists that you be an alcoholic. And, well, in these days with so many young people being drug addicts, whose problem is all one big disease, we should allow them here because there's the other programs don't really help them as much as AA would help them. Just a simple amen will be sufficient. This is a hard place to talk. I guess I wasn't tired last night. You really were bad. Then there's another thought of Dick, our taper. This is his tie. How's it look? Another thought that the Big Book is a very fine instrument. Helps a lot of people. But it's written in an old-fashioned way. It's written circa 1935, 38, 39. It should be maybe updated and a little modernized and a little put into effect for younger people who are coming into AA now and read that and don't connect with it very well. And there's another school of thought that believes too many people in AA are playing doctor. They're telling people not to take necessary medications for their emotional problems, and they're not qualified to tell people not to do that. And maybe are killing people by so doing that. Then there's another school of thought that feels that anonymity is out of date. Maybe at one time to protect the people in 1938 or 40, they slunk around and had to be afraid. But today it's almost a mark of merit to be an AA. You see movie stars and politicians all say, I'm an AA member, and it doesn't seem to affect them at all. And maybe that's what we should do, so that people realize we do have all kinds of people in AA, not just guys in long black overcoats, but guys who are and women who are sharp and alert. And each of these things have a school of thought that they believe to be true. And I just want to discuss those things a little bit today. It's kind of your instructional lecture for the weekend. You can come back and hear Sandy tomorrow and be cleansed of all these thoughts. I didn't mean that as an insult to him. I meant as an insult to you, but that, you know. Anyway. First of all, why in the world have we maintained this isolation of having to be an alcoholic, to be an Alcoholics Anonymous, when so many problems are very similar to ours, heroin addicts and cocaine addicts and pill takers and marijuana smokers, all sorts of people who need the same recovery. And to understand that, we almost have to go back and understand the nature of alcoholism. You know, there's been a history of alcoholism for written history of 4,000 years of people like us. And one of the things that they don't ever write about, I guess, nor should they perhaps, but there seems to be types of alcoholics, at least two major types of alcoholics, and you and I are both familiar with them, although we don't know it, perhaps. There's a type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic, but anywhere you measure them, they drink and get in trouble and have bad times, and something happens that really threatens their security, and they lose a job or they lose their family or somebody dies, and they quit, and they never drink again. And a lot of people, I know several people like that, who don't drink and haven't drank for years, and I wonder why I go to AA. The same type of person who, if they become physically addicted to alcohol. Now, you don't hear much about that, physical addiction to alcohol. You hear about physical addiction to drugs and how dreadful that is. I'll tell you something odd. The physical addiction to alcohol is much more lethal than the physical addiction to drugs. If you take 10 drug addicts and put them in a room, and for 10 days, when they open that door, they're going to be awfully sick. You take 10 addicted alcoholics in that room, half of them will be dead from convulsions and just terrible, smashing their heads, are just terrible. These are the people for whom treatment centers were originally created, to withdraw people medically from addiction, step by step, medically withdraw them, and incidentally along the way show them the nature of their problems, what they've been doing. And there are people like this, and they come out, and they quit, and they never drink again. There's a big hospital up in Seattle called Schick Shadel, and they advertise, "We will cure your alcoholism in 1 month and 2 follow-up visits." Which sounds ridiculous, except they have a whole list of names of people they've done it for. And I know some of the people who come out and say, yeah, that's a trigger of my sobriety. Then there's another type of alcoholic who seems to be an alcoholic, but anywhere you measure them, they drink and get in trouble, can't stop, and something happens that really threatens their security, lose a job, a family, somebody dies, and they quit. But they always eventually drink again. And these same people come out of treatment centers with tears of sincerity rolling down their cheeks. And they quit. But they eventually always drink again. And these are the type of people who have puzzled everyone for all of these years, puzzled people to try to help them. And one time they thought they were possessed by devils. They'd put them to death, if they were sorts, and send them away and hide them. And even in my lifetime, when I was a little boy, I didn't know or didn't care, but I mean, when I was a little boy playing around the streets of Eau Claire, Wisconsin, there still was no answer for these kind of people anywhere. And they had the Keeley cure, where you'd go in and give you some alcohol with drugs in it that made you terribly sick until you drank enough and you said, oh, I don't want any more. But as soon as you got out for about 10 days and you found a bar without any drugs, sorry, I'll try it, you know, boom, nobody ever stayed sober. One of my favorite cures was, had a full page ad in the Times in the late 1970s, tell you how long they keep doing it. A Seventh-day Adventist hospital outside of Los Angeles had a full-page article how they recovered alcoholism without Alcoholics Anonymous or other programs. And I read it with some zeal, of course, to see what the story was. And it turned out, now, Seventh-day Adventists are death against drinking, but they realize it goes on. In their hospital, the White Memorial in Los Angeles, they took one whole ward and made it into a bar room with a bar and a back bar and a bartender. And you send these guys there for treatment. He came in the first morning. The bartender says, want a drink, pal? Well, you got some drugs in there? What's making me say? No drugs, no nothing. Are you sure? Swear it. Pour him a drink. They give him a drink, a little glass that had a cord, so they, I guess, couldn't dig out of their room. Hey, you Seventh-day Adventist, know what you're doing. Give me another one, will you? This went on for several days. The guy started feeling pretty good. Wouldn't have his morning drink. As he took it, they'd shoot a shock through that cord. Hold the ice next time, Jimmy. Yeah. And they'd give him a drink without it. Oh, that's more like it. Then pretty soon they'd give another one with it. After all, these poor guys shoot them all. Do you want a drink? Yeah. And pretty soon they come in the morning and say, do you want a drink? No, I don't believe I do. And if they did that for a week, they knew that they had beaten it. And they had 100% recovery. And it was really wonderful. But for 2 years, somebody did a follow-up, and they were all drunk. You know, most of them hadn't got beyond the first bar that didn't have a cord on their glass. You wonder why do these people keep drinking? And science has tried everything they know how, and religion has done a lot of things. They've scourged them and they've prayed over them. And medical people have worked in any way to try to find someone. This anabuse, which was the miracle cure of the 1950s. Take anabuse and you'd be too sick to drink. And it just turned out that people like us forgot to take our anabuse. Damn it, I forgot to take it again. Well, shit. Most of us haven't seen many of these intricate plans that people do. What people like us are familiar with seeing is the look in the face of somebody who loves us. That terrible look of sadness and, oh, how could you? Look at you. You promised. You were doing better. And the children were feeling better. And now you're drunk. How could you get drunk? And there's the only answer to that I know is, leave me alone. Because I don't know either. I don't know either. All I know is it seemed all right at the time. And these are the type of people that baffle everybody. And these are the type of people that everyone has tried to help forever. And in 1935, these two guys got together in Akron, Ohio. Which, incidentally, you think about this. There was a matter of seconds and inches a little before that we almost didn't get here. Bill Wilson got sober in his spiritual experience and went to work at the Oxford Group and helped drunks and took people at home and took care of them and take them to meetings. And the Oxford group, you know, is pretty high quality people. And they sat in private homes. They discussed things intellectually. And Bill Wilson would bring these old rotten street drunks in, and they'd sit there and they'd, "I believe you're vomiting on my shoe."
Yeah.
Which is one of the reasons they try to discourage you. But Bill Wilson did this for 6 months. One morning he got up, and the guy he'd brought home last night, he was going to help, decamped early in the morning. Apparently took some stuff out of the kitchen to sell for wine again. His little wife got up, who remembers had married this little cute little society girl. She was now old before her time, trying to live with this condition. And she had started to get gray, and she put on her little sweater with a patch on the sleeve, going off to her work in the cheap department store so she could make enough money to pay for his not doing anything. And he had a terrible wave of self-revulsion. And he said, "Oh, Lois." He said, "I'll tell you, I don't know what happened. That hospital, I thought something good had happened to me, but I'm going to quit doing this. I'm going to get a job. For 6 months, I've tried to help people, and not one person has stayed sober, and I'm all done doing it." And right then, your life and mine hung by the thinnest thread possible. And she turned and said something that changed the course of history. I had lunch with her a number of years ago in Connecticut. I said, "How in the world did you ever think of that great answer, Lois? Did you change the course of history?" She said, "I don't know. It seems so clear to me." He said, "Not one person has stayed sober." And she said, "You did." "Oh, yeah." That's why old-timers don't have much hair in front. Just go there. So we decided to try it again, and a couple of weeks later, met Dr. Bob. But if he had that answer, he wouldn't have, but we wouldn't be here. But anyway, what happened was, as you remember the story, Dr. Bob didn't want to talk to this guy. Drunk under the table, as you so nicely put it. Your type of guy, was that? Yeah. I'm his sponsor. That is his type of guy. Anyway. His wife said he can't come and meet anybody today because he's too drunk, but he can come tomorrow. So his son, Dr. Bob's son, young Smitty, they called him. He's dead now. But he talks about going out there and driving his father out there because his father's too sick to drive. And he's telling his mother, he said, "Ann, I'll talk to this man for 15 to 20 minutes, but I can't stand any more lectures on my drinking. I'll do something about it. I'm trying to do something about it. I don't need more damn lectures." And they get out there, and these two guys finally went into a room to give him his 15 minutes, and they come out 4 hours later. And Dr. Bob was different. He said, "Ann, I don't know. That's the first man I ever talked to who seemed to know why I drink, or what makes me drink, or how I feel." And Bill, of course, was not doing well at the moment. He'd just blown a big deal there. He had $10 left in his pocket. Either he could pay his hotel bill or go home. And Bob said, "Could you possibly stay with us a few weeks and we could talk some more about this?" And Bill thought, "I have no way to get out of town." "Yes, I can." Yeah. So things just worked out fine. And they stayed there. And you remember, for 2 weeks, they both were Oxford U members. They talked about spiritual matters and deep spiritual understandings and breakthroughs. And then Dr. Bob, as you remember, sobered out 2 weeks and with hope went to Atlantic City to the American Medical Association convention and told Bill, he said, "Stay with my wife." He said, "Last year I was there drunk and they all ridiculed me, but this year I'm going to show them that I'm a different man." And off he went, and Bill stayed home. And Monday morning the phone rang, and it was Dr. Bob's office nurse. She said, "Oh, Mrs. Smith, I'm so sorry. They carried the doctor off the train this morning so drunk he couldn't walk. And he was laying face down on the platform. And so the station agent called me, and I went down and got him with the cab driver, and he's on the floor of his office now. I'm so sorry. I know that he was doing better." So Bill and Ann went down to get him, took this drunken, "Oh, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry," took him home, put him to bed. And right there, your life and mine almost was extinguished. And about Wednesday, he woke up with, "Oh, God, what day is it?" He said, "Wednesday, Mom. Oh, my God. I got to do a surgery today. And look at my hand. I can't do a surgery. I got to do a cancer surgery." my God, what can I do? I'll lose my license. My God, what did I do? And they got him up, got him a bath, and cleaned him up, and Bill bought him some booze to settle his hand. They dropped him off the hospital about 11 o'clock in the morning, went home to wait for him, and he didn't come home at 12, or 1, or 2, or 3, or 4. And they knew exactly what happened. He stopped for one drink. That's the end of it. And all of a sudden, about 6 o'clock, he burst through the door, sober, glowing. Where you been, Bob? He said, I was doing that surgery. It struck me. You know, in the Oxford group, they want you to make amends to people. And I thought a doctor shouldn't have to make amends. But it struck me, I'm not a doctor, I'm an alcoholic. And so I've been all day making amends to people. And I feel wonderful. And that was June 10th, 1935, which is a big day in our lives. And they decided, sitting around talking about spiritual matters, this is what helped them. Instead, they went up to the Akron Hospital, found another drunk, and talked to him. And I heard him talk a number of years ago. His name was Bill D. He said, I was laying in that bed in Akron, Ohio. And my wife came to me and said, two men want to talk to me about my drinking. And I was so damn sick of people talking to me about my drinking. I said, I'm not going to talk to anybody else about my drinking. But she's a strong woman. So I talked to those two fellas about my drinking. They never talked to me about my drinking once. They talked to me about their drinking and how they felt and why they drank. He said, I couldn't believe it. That's the first time I ever heard people understand how I felt. I was so impressed. I stuck with them fellas and been with them ever since. And so we began. And I don't want to get off on this. I just want to throw in one little anecdote and cheer you up, I hope, for tonight. They got a few guys. They lost a few guys. They finally got one young guy. He was 29, came around. Ernie. And he was kind of young, and they didn't know if he'd even be an alcoholic. They didn't know the youngest guy was Bill. He was 39. But he came around for a while, did what they did, and fell in love with Dr. Bob's daughter. And I'm only mentioning this because you young people know who opened the door, brought us our first relationship. I don't know any word that more sends a shiver down a sponsor's spine than to hear that word. I found a new relationship. Oh, Jesus. You hope you just have a phone with the on. And they got married, which was lovely. It's kind of lovely. And that happened in my life. My youngest daughter married a guy I sponsored named Tom Nutman. And I was against it, but the women knew more than I did, of course. So I want to tell you the absolute golden example of mixed emotions. It's watching your youngest daughter glowingly go down the aisle to marry a man whose fifth step you've heard. You can't really say anything because of, you know, but you can give hints. You say, let me know if he ever brings a sheep home, honey. And of course they told him now, you got a new bride. You shouldn't be running around the way we are at all these meetings to try and help all these people. You stay home and take care of your wife for a while. So he did and got drunk and died and turned her against AA for the next 50 years. But AA little by little grew, as we all know. But it all is boiled down to this. No amount of information has ever seemed to help alcoholics of our type. Alcoholics are the type who drink again, who wind up in rooms like this. No information has ever been, no formula has ever been helped. The only thing that's ever seemed to help any of us is that someone has enabled us to believe someone else may know how I feel. Because whatever we are, when we all come here, I think we all have one thing in common, among other things. We all secretly know that my case is different. I know you mean well, and I know you want to help me, but I have unusual things that you're not familiar with. And there's a suit of armor, and you can talk, and it just bounces off the armor. And here's you. Yeah, thanks a lot. And most people never get off that armor. That's why most people like us still die drunk. But some people do, once in a while. you'd be able to get a word in. Oh, well, I understand that feeling. And you open your armor briefly. Huh, for heaven's sake. Oh. And little by little, exploit that. And little by little, because I think the most important single factor in sobriety for people of our type is somewhere along the line finding enough identification so you can believe what the person is telling you. It isn't just some more boilerplate. And little by little, that is the whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous. And every step of the way in Alcoholics Anonymous, wherever there was a change, it was changed because of someone believed someone else and took action sometimes they didn't believe in because someone they believed told them to do it. And little by little, that's the whole story of Alcoholics Anonymous. A great many people still can't get through to. I see people like us die or dying every day of my life, my work. And I've been able to sponsor a lot of people, and I can't get through to them. I have a son who's an alcoholic. His wife is gone. He's about to lose his big deal job. He's been surrounded by AA since the day he was born, and I cannot get through to him. I know why I can't get through to him, though, because I'm his dad. You know, that's why dads, you can't get through to your parents. You can't get through to your son and daughter. You can't get through to your children. You can't get through to your sisters and brothers. Because it isn't AA talking. It's just dad talking. Some more advice from dad. Who cares? You don't understand. I have three daughters who are 18 years sober this year. And none of them ever asked me for any help. And that's why they're sober. But there's a lot of people who don't get it. But the people who do love it. At least they should love it. They should be very grateful. We sometimes forget that. But over the years, the whole story. Now, in the 1940s, after the Saturday Evening Post had this article on AA, which many brought forth a lot of people. There were groups formed all over the United States, and geez, some in Canada, some in one Ireland. And it really took off. And then after that, in 1942 and 43, Bill, sitting in New York, started getting letters. Our group is dying. People are all getting drunk again. Gee, they get fighting all the time. There's terrible fights. And in addition to those terrible fights, there were two great fights, or one great fight in AA, the great fight between the Akron AA and the New York AA. Bill and Bob always got along together, but their followers fought and scared. You know, people in Akron, people in Los Angeles, the A's National, would not have anything to do with the New York AA or the Akron A's. They'd only write to New York. The A's in Chicago would have nothing to do with New York, only write to Akron. All over the country, people fighting, and then all sorts of things. People fighting and debating and having a terrible time. And one by one, the meetings were ending. By 1944, it looked as though AA was on the way out. And Bill Wilson, in an effort to try to save AA, did what he thought it could do. He started the Grapevine as some sort of unifying force. It wasn't the size it is now. It was that size. Started once a month. And that helped a little, not much. And by early 1945, AA was about to go. We're not right to go right then, but it's on that path. And a doctor in North Carolina wrote an article for the Grapevine and sent it in. Said, Bill, this is my find interesting. And Bill read this article, and he couldn't. He read across an organization just exactly almost like AA that had expired. It turned out, as old-timers know this, newcomers may not. In 1840, just 100 years before, six drunks got together in Baltimore. One had just gotten out of jail again. He went back to his friends. Oh, that damn chaplain down there says he knows how I feel, but he doesn't know how I feel. You guys are there, you guys know how I feel. Yeah, we all know. But this drinking's killing us. Maybe we could all help each other stay sober. So they decided to help each other stay sober. They drew up a little agreement, and they signed it. And there were five officers and one member, just, you know, like any normal group of AA. And people laugh at you. You can give them, you drunken boobs. You can't even keep store yourself. You're going to help them. But they stayed sober. And some people came down from Philadelphia and went back and tried to start it there. And some people came from Washington. And somebody came from Boston. That got to be red hot in Boston. And all of they'd never heard of a group like this before, drunkards helping drunkards, like the first of a kind. So this is just like George Washington, the first of a kind. We'll call ourselves the Washingtonians. And they did. At the end of a year, they had about several hundred members in several cities. At the end of the second year, they had in about 10 states. And what they did then, Washington's birthday they chose as their anniversary. They started a few days after that. But they sent out a letter to all their membership in 1842 and said, you know, people still think we're some kind of crazy people. They don't know what we're doing. What we suggest you do, get somebody from your community who is well thought of. Not a big shot, because they won't come, but get somebody who's a comer and have them come in and talk. And not that we care what he says, but he'll see what we're doing and talk about us. So in 1842, all over the country, people came into the Washingtonians. In Springfield, Illinois, one they got was a young lawyer named Abraham Lincoln. And he, if you read a book of Lincoln's speeches, you'll read about his speech to the Washingtonians. And a lot of it's just long speech. But the paragraph is so touching. He said, you know, I know you men. I know you in this city. I know you're intelligent and good men. I just don't understand your thirst. I don't have your thirst. But since you have your thirst, I'm so glad you're doing something about it. And by 1843, the big entertainments in the world at that time in the country were mass meetings. There was no television, no radio, no nothing. They have a mass meeting. They bring in some interesting speaker and he'd talk. And they got a couple of these interesting speakers into the Washingtonians. So they went out and talked up the Washingtonians to mass people. And by 1845, they estimated their membership was 100,000 sober drunkards. And what they did then, that seems reasonable, because it seems reasonable to people now. Well, if we're able to help drunkards, we should be able to help all sorts of people. We should help people who have narcotic problems, who are not alcoholics. We should be able to maybe stamp out the sale of alcohol. Maybe we should get into work in politics and help stamp out slavery. Maybe we should get into politics and try to get, we can get Texas in the Union. Things like this. And they all got involved in it and just gung-ho. And by 1848, the Washingtonians were extinct and they all died drunk, except very few exceptions. I have a book written by one of the few survivors in 1861. He said, don't know what happened. We were doing so well and we're getting all these good things and people didn't want to come and help drunkards anymore. Where they went. And Bill read this and was astonished. He said, my God, that's what's happening to us. Not that exactly, but I can see how they fought for recognition and they fought for money and they fought for who's going to get the most juice and on and on. And in 1945, reading the Washingtonians, reading his letters, in a last gasp effort to save AA, he sat down and wrote the 12 traditions. Based on the Washingtonian experience, pretty much. Not in the way we have them here, but in the long form, which, in case you're in New York, in the back of the book, they're on the page across from here. And they really flesh it out a little bit more. They really tell you more about it. In my home group in Los Angeles, we read the long form once a month, just to make sure everybody knows what it is. And he introduced them one by one in the grapevine. And unfortunately, AA at that time had the same major problem it has now. We don't know how to overcome it. It's full of alcoholics. Crazy. Nasty bunch. You know. We don't want your damn rules. We're here to find love. Yeah. A lot of people wouldn't take it. And Bill, you read about it, rides around in his motorcycle, little towns, and his wife in the sidecar explaining that these aren't really rules. We're trying to do things. And so sad of the archives in New York. They have a couple letters that say, Dear Bill, please come and speak at our anniversary, only if you promise not to talk about the traditions. If you're going to talk about the traditions, don't even come. We'll get somebody else. I mean, that much how much feeling it was. And by 1949, some people had accepted it. Some people didn't. And Bill and Dr. Bob decided, we have to somehow get all these warring elements together somehow. And they said, maybe we could just have one meeting somewhere where all these people from California, meet people from Florida, meet people from Akron, meet people from New York, we get along. So they told their followers, find us a place to meet. And the people in Akron said, well, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to New York. And the people in New York, not to be outdone in spirituality, we'll go to a meeting. We won't go to Akron. So Bill and Dr. Bob got together and they, Cleveland. Right. So the first major group of sober alcoholics got together in Cleveland, Ohio, the end of July 1950. And I have the tapes of that convention. It's fascinating. The quality of the tapes are bad, but you hear that, you know, most of the speakers were non-alcoholics. They're still trying to impress people that they're not really eccentric. The warden of San Quentin talked, and the head of somebody from the government, and this and that. One of the highlights was on Sunday afternoon, they had Bill and Dr. Bob talk. Dr. Bob was dying of cancer, so they thought he probably wouldn't talk. He said, you want to talk to you, Bob? He said, I've got to talk. He said, I'm 15 years sober. Next to Bill, I've got the longest sobriety in the world. And so that day, his son on one side, and he took this tall, gaunt man to the podium, and he gave a little talk, which has gone down in history as the Gettysburg Address of Alcoholics Anonymous. He so wanted to communicate, and he's the first part of his talk was just kind of blather. I mean, you usual talk, you know. I want to welcome you all to Cleveland. I hope you boys go back and tell the boys and girls in your group that we're all here, we're all doing the same thing. We get out of AA what we put into it. And he said, I'm glad that some small thing I did a number of years ago helped bring this about. I want to apologize for my health. I have been in bed most of the past few months. My health hasn't returned the way I hoped it would. And, you know, just talk. But then, he said, but before I sit down, I'd like to call your attention to two or three things that I think may be of interest to all of us. And in the next 2 minutes, he hit it right on. It says, germane tonight in Virginia Beach as it was then. He said, first, let us remember to keep our program simple. Let's not louse it all up with Freudian complexes, which may be of interest to the scientific mind, but has nothing to do with our work here. Our work here, when reduced to the last, consists of love and service. And we all know what love is. We all know what service is. And secondly, he said, let us guard that erring member, the tongue, and try to use it with kindness and understanding. And there isn't a person in this room or any room like it who doesn't know exactly what he's talking about. We're all wonderful people when things are going our way. Yeah, well, it works. Love's the answer. But if somebody hurt our feelings or say something bad, you're on pills, you son of a bitch. And finally he said, let us remember, none of us would be here today if someone hadn't taken the time to explain things to us, to maybe take us to a few meetings, to give us a pat on the back when we needed it. I hope none of us ever reach that stage of smug complacency where we are unable to help our fellow man, who fellow sufferer. That's all. Thank you. And he sat down and died shortly thereafter. But the highlight of that meeting really was they had six young guys get up. I don't know who they were, but they sounded on the tape as though their tails were wagging, just excited. And they explained the traditions, what they were for, and there weren't rules. We have no enforcement procedures. It's just that we're trying to save AA, and did a very good job. At the end of it, Bill Wilson got up, and I'm sure he was still not quite sure that these pukes are going to vote for it. So he said, we have now heard the traditions read. Seeing no objections, they're accepted. And saved our bacon. And they began to, again, to grow a little bit and flourish because people had a structure in their meetings and their programs to know that we have to practice self, to lower our egos to understand what we're here for. But anyway, so AA really grew. But even so, all of these years, the biggest next thing that happened in the 1950s, late 1950s, there was a guy in Los Angeles named Jim Willis, who was a gambler as well as an alcoholic. And he would bring his gambler friends to AA to see if you could be helped. And I don't understand all this talk about drinking. I don't want to go to that meeting, Jim. So he wrote to New York, became the first person to ever get permission to use the 12 steps in another program. And he founded Gamblers Anonymous. And he founded Gamblers Anonymous and became the most successful of all the non-AA 12 step groups. All over the world now, if you go to a GA meeting, you see Jim Willis's picture on the wall like we see Bill Wilson's. I knew him quite well as a good man. In the mid-1960s, he was so active in GA, just traveling all over in GA, that he really didn't have time for AA much to speak of. So everybody was very sad when he got drunk and died. But as they said in GA, he never gambled again. And then the next year, over in North Hollywood, some guys who were heroin addicts as well as alcoholics wrote and got permission to use the 12-step for Narcotics Anonymous. Then a couple years later, out in the west side of town, some guys got formed Cocaine Anonymous. Then a lady formed Overeaters Anonymous. And these are the four big ones, of course, and they're all quite successful using our steps. But only for one reason. The steps were the same, the recovery's the same. But people didn't identify unless they were hearing someone with the same problem they had. I really didn't understand that ever until I was about 2 years sober. I was doing pretty well. I had a job, had no front teeth, but I learned to carry my lip like shit. And I was holding forth at the club one day on obsessions. I'm an authority on obsessions, not the recovery from them, just the obsessions themselves. And I got done to this plump lady came up for she says, "Oh," she said, "Clancy, that was so interesting. I've just formed a group called Overeaters Anonymous. Would you come over and talk to our ladies on Sunday?" And I weighed about 130 pounds then. Sure, I'll give them something to shoot for. So I went over there on Sunday and went in this room about 7 or 8 plump ladies sitting around the table and I gave them a wonderful talk at Obsession. They liked it. And I sat down. I thought, glad to help girls. Then they had a little sharing session, and I couldn't believe what I was hearing. A woman over here had a little boy, just had his 10th birthday. He was in a military school in Long Beach. Her husband was down to get him. She had the birthday cake ready for him. She took one little bite to make sure it was all right. And then one more little bite. By the time I got back, the whole cake was gone. And she felt just so terrible about it. And I didn't say anything, because I'm a too nice a guy. But I thought to myself, Jesus, just take a piece of the cake and forget it. For Christ's sake, what's wrong with you? You know? Woman over here talking about eating ice cream. She said, uh-huh. And her husband, angry that she eats ice cream, he sent her out at night to have her ice cream. Just, as soon as he leaves for work, she's got a cast there. She just loves ice cream. And I didn't say anything. I'm a nice guy. I thought to myself, no wonder you're fat, for Christ's sake. Anybody would be fat eating ice cream like that. My favorite was this woman over here who said she ate till she couldn't eat anymore, then put her finger down her throat and vomited it up so she could eat some more. And I didn't say anything. But I thought to myself, don't bother shaking hands with me after the meeting. Greasy old finger. I mean, I can see doing that for drinking, but not eating. I've done it for drinking a lot. My Saturday afternoon sun still up. I'm drunk. Shit. Now, what was the difference? I understood very well. My mind was clearer than it is tonight. I understood very clearly. I didn't identify with it. It was just ridiculous information, which is the same thing that happens to us when we try to share with our non-alcoholic families these things. They don't understand it. What do you mean? Can't you just have a glass of wine? We think they're being rude, but they really don't understand it all. Because it all boils down to identification. Whether identification is just information. And that is why, really, Alcoholics Anonymous wants you to be an alcoholic, to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. So you can talk about something that's identifying to the people. You could be an alcoholic and a narcotic addict. You could be an alcoholic and a cocaine addict. And an overeater and a gambler. You can twist baby chickens' necks for all we care. But you got to be an alcoholic. And another thing, if you're new, let me suggest something else to you. If you are an alcoholic and a narcotic addict, when you get up to speak, you say, my name is John Doe, and I'm an alcoholic. When you say, I'm an anda, you immediately are saying, look, I'm different, which is the wrong direction for people like us to go. We've got to work everything we can to get over that difference, those differences. So really, that is the reason. We're not being exclusive towards people. We just have to... I enjoyed what Beth said about her little relative, that they don't know if they're going to... Most families save for a college education. She's saving for a treatment center. I have a grandson like that. A great grandson, I should say. And I have a little different take on it. I don't know if he's either a potential alcoholic or he's the spawn of the devil. I look at the back of his little neck from time to time to see if there's a 666. So I presume he must be an alcoholic. But when he walks through this door sometime, I hope he'll sit down and hear people talk about things that he identifies with, not some glittering talk about some addiction that he doesn't have where it's just meaningless. I mean, I've been working with addicts for over 35 years. I probably know more about addiction than most addicts. But when I come to a room like this, I want to sit down and I want to hear, I don't care how glib the addictive talk is, shooting up or sniffing up or whatever it might be. It's just information. Interesting. Kind of music. Good. But where it touches my heart, some boob gets up there, big dummy. Well, I've been drunk a lot. It's been really hell. Jim was trying to help me. Going to meetings every night and doing dumb things. And I guess I'm feeling better. You bet. I know how that feels. That is why you have to be an alcoholic to be an alcoholic. It isn't a matter of exclusion. And the phrase, it's all one big disease. You know where that came from? It came from a treatment center that only had one van. Secondly, I talked too long on that subject. I'll have to quiz through the next three or four, the next 3 minutes. Then there's some other things, too. And that's all. But they want to upgrade the big book. That sounds good. Big book, why not? It's kind of written archaically, it seems like, sometimes. The book's a nice book. And you hear people say things like, this book is a miracle. And you know, oh, Jesus. Everybody knows if there's a word that's overused in AA, it's miracle. Everybody's a miracle. Heard a guy a few years ago said, I got up really early this morning. And I looked at the eastern sky and the sun was rising. And I said, it's a miracle. I've been given another day of sobriety. Oh, Jesus. Get up early tomorrow and have another miracle, you goomball. You know. Miracles are supposed to be unexplainable or inexplicable, as we like to say. They're not supposed to be understandable. Why is this book a miracle? Well, for one thing, let's begin what the book is. The book is not... it's not a cure-all at all. What the book truly is, when you think about it, it has some good stories in it, but it is a cookbook. It has a series of recipes. That's why people can master this book and keep getting drunk. It's like mastering a cookbook and wondering why you're starving. You haven't cooked yet. Yeah. You have to do these things. You have to take these actions. And you must... And that's why there's a whole school in AA now where they study the book and get together and study the book and go over the book, and you can't get them to help anybody. You can't get them to do anything. We've got our book study again tonight, and they're going to talk about this true meaning of the first sentence of chapter 3. Jesus. And they... which is all right. If they want to do it, that's fine. But in my understanding of alcoholism, this book is written... Now, it is not written as an entertaining thing. It is it deals with human emotions, not intellect. Intellectually, this book is not... I mean, it's a good book, but it's not a cutting edge of intellect. But it deals with human emotions and what to do about them. And doesn't seem to be a great deal to anybody who reads it who aren't familiar with AA. But what makes it a miracle is this. It was written by a guy that didn't know enough to write it. 3 years sober, writing this book. It's kind of funny. Young people today, or my year even, said, 3 years sober. God, they must know enough to write a book by then. That's a long time. But you get to be 3 years sober, you realize you don't know enough to write a book. By the time you're 5 years sober, you just try to be nice to people 3 years sober. Come on back, Jimmy, you're doing a good job. By the time you're 10 years sober, you hate to send people 3 years sober for your coffee. Was that one cream and two sugars, or one sugar and two cream? I'll get it myself. By the time you're 20 years sober, you hate to have people 3 years sober, unattended on your property. Let's see how they work out before I let them loose. But this guy, 3 years sober, surrounded mostly by failure. We forget that. Most of these people were all getting around. He's very, very few people stayed with him for a while in the early days. In fact, when they wrote the book, what a great breakthrough. Got these guys to write these stories in the back. Most of them drank again. You know, sobriety was a tenuous thing. But he wrote this book that he didn't know enough to write. And it's a miracle because that book has changed more alcoholic lives of our type than all other therapies combined in the history of mankind. Now, that's a miracle. And is so... Did you move over there? There's going to be a Greek chorus out here. Anyway... But that really is a miracle. And people say, well, up to... Now I say, why don't you show me what you mean? Give me an example. I'm not going to change something that works for something that somebody 28 minutes sober thinks is wrong. Screw you. Yeah. Let's see it. Let's see it. Try it somewhere for about a year or two. Then I'll try it. That book is not... no doubt it's not fascinating. When I first got sober, my sponsor had me read that book. First time I came to AA. And all my reaction was, this is one of the dullest books I've ever read. Many years later, I came off Skid Row, with everything kicked out of me. Went to AA, and my new sponsor said, read this book. And I read it, and much to my surprise, it was even duller than I remembered. But as a result of taking actions, the book came alive. It's the only book I know in the world that gets smarter every year you're sober. Huh, that wasn't there last year. Yeah. Really, great thing. I don't think we'll change the book at this time. It was brought up a couple of years ago in New York, the big convention of delegates. Let's change the book. And thank God it was voted down. We'll change the stories, because they're opinions, but not that first 164 pages, because that works. Then there's one more thing about the playing doctor. And I suppose it is irritating to hear people tell you what not to do something your doctor told you to do. But one thing that's kind of dangerous in AA today, there's such a plethora of new feel-good pills that a lot of people get on them. For example, antidepressants. I don't think it's much of a big secret that most of the treatment centers now put them on antidepressants. They come out of there addicted to antidepressants. They say, but you can't get addicted to these antidepressants. No, you can't, but you are. Just like you can't get addicted to alcohol unless you're an alcoholic. But we get addicted to anything that makes us feel good. And they come out, and what people don't realize, they're designed for short-term use. In the long run, many times, they turn on the taker and make them more depressed and cause suicides. There's all sorts of literature on that subject. And I'll tell you, when I see somebody on antidepressants, if I'm responsible, if they ask me to be responsible for their actions, I tell them I want you to get off them. But they're so strong now, you can't just get off them. So I don't know anybody else does, but I say, I'll go to your doctor with you, and let's try to wean you off little by little by little. Because some of these things are so now, you get off them, you become psychotic almost. And little by little, to get off them. And I'm not telling anybody not to take these medications. I'm just saying, are you willing to try to get off them? Maybe you need them. One of the most humorous things, to me, sadly humorous, this whole epidemic of bipolarism. People are bipolar all of a sudden. Just more. It's a worse epidemic than smallpox ever was. You know, just, when they first came out, I thought, God, if that's what bipolar, I'm tripolar because I'm sicker than all of them. You know. But I'll tell you what, you know, it's nothing unusual. A great many alcoholics suddenly discover they're bipolar. And some of them may be, which is another term for manic depression. That's all it is. It's manic depression under a new cloak. But you stop and think about it sometimes. What are the symptoms of manic depression? Highs and lows. And highs and lows. Which is the same symptoms for bipolarism, of course. Highs and lows. What are the symptoms of early sobriety? Highs and lows. And you go see your doctor. I'm having highs and lows, doctor. There you are. And they mean well, but Dr. Paul Oliver, who had a story in the book, still does, I guess. But he told me one time, he said, you can't blame the doctors. They sit in their office and some neurotic comes in whining about their feelings, and there's 10 people in the waiting room who are really sick and need to be helped. So he's, here, take this and take it as deal. Next. And I suppose some of the people need medications. When I was released from the Texas State Insane Asylum, where I'd been placed unfairly, because I successfully committed suicide. That's not a mark of illness. That's a mark of breakthrough. But then I escaped, and they put me back in the electric shock treatments for 3 months. So I was really kind of strange when I got out of there. What's your name, boy? I don't know. They know at the desk. And I was on massive doses of Thorazine, and I was supposed to take it for the rest of my natural life. He says, your emotions are so intense, you've got to do something. So I took those, and God, 3 times a day I took them. I went back to work, and I was able to work a little bit, and never caused any trouble to anybody. Then the next time I got drunk and in trouble, I ran out of dough and couldn't fill my prescription. And I never got around to filling it again until I got sober this time. And I thought, God, maybe I should take those Thorazine. But I had no money. So I thought, as soon as I get on my feet, I'll get them. By the time I got on my feet, I'd done enough things so I didn't need them. Because it turns out the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous countered those sick emotions as well as anything I had. So I'm a little prejudiced a little bit against the perpetual use of medications to alter perceptions. But as far as I can see, the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is exactly the same as what Bob said today and other people have said, is the same as the medications, to alter my perception of reality. The same reason I drank alcohol. I drank alcohol in order to change my perception of life, to change my relationship to the people around me. Hi, Granny. You with anyone? And that's what AA is about, it seems to me. That's what these medications are about, to change my perception of reality. That's why they call this a disease of perception. Because nothing has to change in our life. We just have to change our insides, and the same things look different. The same things look different. The towns I hated, I get to yearn for, you know, all sorts of dumb things, and hold jobs and get along with people, but still have a lot. There's a tiger in there lurking. I know that because once in a while, I'll tell you, in 1970, I went to the International Convention, and I was asked to give a short talk in Miami Beach, and I was thrilled because the first speaker that morning was the guy who took me to my first meeting. The last speaker that day was my current sponsor, Chuck C, and I was the noon speaker, and God, I was just surrounded by people, and I gave a goofy talk, and at that night, I thought to myself, you know, at that time, they had just started holding hands for the Lord's Prayer. It came out of Brentwood, a big effete group in Los Angeles. And so I never would hold hands. That's true. People on both sides had their hands. Not me. I'm alone with my God. Get away from me. But down there, I thought, I got to stop being such a horse's ass. I'm going to start holding hands. I'm going to get along with people. I'm going to bring this. I'm sober 12 years. I should bring some spiritual understanding instead of being such a controversial puke. And I came home, and the next day I decided to go to work. I'm really going to knock him dead. Got on the Santa Monica Freeway, came underneath the harbor or the San Diego Freeway. A little woman came off in a car and almost killed me. Just missed me that much. And the new spiritual leader of the West Coast had his window up and said, "For Christ's sake, what are you doing up there?" Well, maybe I'll go to a couple more meetings. I've never seen anyone in AA or anyplace else if you press the right buttons who don't give. Which is the same reason, I guess, even though this is considered old-fashioned, I don't have any alcohol at my house. So I watched two guys, in a moment of insane rage, grab a bottle and drink that they wouldn't have done if they had to go outside to the next door to get it. When my daughter got married, we had a reception in the backyard, a lot of champagne. I kept it in the garage overnight. If I wanted to drink, I'd go drink it. But I wouldn't get up half asleep and crazy and drink it. Because I just think there's a tiger in all of us that we have to make sure he stays in his cage. But I think that if anybody comes to me tomorrow or Monday or Wednesday night at the meeting and says, "I want you to be my sponsor. I want you to help me," or whatever it is, and I'm on medications, first thing I'm going to say is, "Well, you may need them, but let's try it without them, little by little. Because otherwise you may die as a result of them." So that's all. I don't think people should play doctor. Get off those things. But I think you ought to think about maybe finding a way to help them. And the last thing, of course, is anonymity. Why should we remain anonymous? Maybe once upon a time when people had to carry that... Talk about this old, the first book with a big yellow cover, people would take the covers off and put it on backwards so people wouldn't see what a garish thing Alcoholics Anonymous. But over the years, it's become almost a mark of distinction to be a sober alcoholic. I don't mind telling people, I'm also people who are Alcoholic Anonymous member. Why would we maintain anonymity? At one time, they thought, of course, that it was to protect people. But over the years, it evolved into something entirely different. It evolved into a spiritual entity where you are surrendering your ego to the movement. You know, some people, young people here, may not know what anonymity really means. Because of the nature of my work in Los Angeles, I get interviewed sometimes in the newspaper, and I'm on television. And I've had an article about me in magazines, and they always list me as a recovered alcoholic. They say, "See, that man is breaking his anonymity." I'm not. That's what I am. I would call it recovering, but a recovered alcoholic. What anonymity is, if they ever mention AA, then you can't no longer use my name or my face or nothing, because I must not use AA for my purposes. And so anonymity is, I remember, I used to go to the radio in the 1970s when AA was still kind of, or 60s, I guess, still kind of newer. They'd have people come on the radio and talk to real alcoholics. "We have a real alcoholic in our talk show tonight." They'd give you a phony name. I was Alcoholic Al. And one night this guy said to me, he said, "Al, you mean to say that you parked your car in your garage and shut the door and put a hose on the exhaust pipe and let it into the car, and you turn on the motor, and you actually died?" I said, "Yes." I just told him that. It didn't surprise me. He said, and he had tears in his eyes. Said, "Al, you're the first person I've ever known that actually tried to kill himself." And I guess I'd been in AA too long. I said, "My God, you're the first person I met who didn't. You know." What kind of life is it without a suicide now and then? Yeah. But it turns out the theory of anonymity, the last letter Bill Wilson wrote was a letter describing the spiritual effect of anonymity, why we must maintain anonymity. It doesn't matter if we're trying to hide or protect ourselves. We're trying to hide our own egos from ourselves. That was in there partially because of the Washingtonian experience where they fought over who was the most impressive speaker and who was the most impressive guy, and they would get drunk over fighting over it. The spiritual aspects of anonymity are to subordinate my ego and to live with some... I think the greatest thing is the long form of the 12 traditions, they describe it. So I guess we're here, the things I talked about tonight, That's why we have to be alcoholic, so somebody new sitting that off room can understand what you're saying. And secondly, I think most of us would like to see a sample of the new book before we accept it. Let's make sure it works. And we don't want this to turn into a group of pill-crazed, technically, alcoholically sober people. I want to get my medallion tonight if I can find where the podium is. And finally, we want to maintain our anonymity. And the end of the long form of the 12 traditions is so beautiful. It encompasses. I just love this phrase. Why should we do all these things? This to the end, that our great blessings shall never spoil us, that we shall forever live in thankful contemplation of Him who presides over us all. Thank you.